Testing, 1, 2, 3.
This is Dan Austin at the home of Steve Suchok, former Major League Baseball player with the Yankees and Chicago White Sox in the 1940s and 1950s. The date is March the 11th, 1991, at his home in Plantation, Florida. This recording is for the archives of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Steve, thank you for accepting this invitation. You're a Pennsylvanian by birth, and you played your early baseball in the Pittsburgh-Greensburg area. When were you born?
I was born March the 3rd, 1919. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I started out playing ball in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, in the Penn State League. And it's kind of a funny story. In those days, there wasn't a lot of money around, and we had a couple of fellas that met in college, and they put a ball club in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, in the Penn State League. And they didn't have any working agreement or anything. Like, they had regular tryouts in Greensburg, and I had gone down with a friend of mine from my little old town. It wasn't too far from there. And we left on the money. We both went home on Wednesday. I was sick. I had the flu. They says, "What do you get?" "Well, come on back." Well, anyhow, I had gone back the following Monday, and the season started on Friday. In those days, you didn't come to Florida spring training. And I made the ball club, and I was only there a short time in June.
We started out at first base then?
Started out at first base, yes. And nobody was coming to the ball games, and we didn't get paid, 1939. And, you know, the woman that fed us in those days, I think we ate for $5 a week.
So you stayed in a boarding house?
We stayed in a boarding house, and we stayed in a rooming house for $3 a week. But we couldn't pay her because we weren't getting paid. Nobody came to the ballpark. Bill Skiff was in Butler, Pennsylvania, and I understand this is the story. Excuse me, it's the story I get. Bill Skiff was in Butler. That was the Yankee Farm Club, and both general managers were talking, and one of them said, "I don't know how I'm going to meet my payroll." And so Skiff, you heard the remark, and he said, "What do you want for that big kid on first base?" Now, this is Skiff telling me this years later. So they sold me to the Yankees in 1939 in June, and they got enough money. I don't know what enough money was in those days, but they made a road club out of the ball club for the rest of the year. That's how,
valuable you were.
Yeah.
How'd you get, I guess you played in high school then, in around Greensburg then?
Well, I played on around the 8th ward. My brother was a great athlete in that area. He was a little older than I was, and I played for the high school team, and I played for Katanning when I was still going to high school. I didn't know what the rules were, and really didn't care. But my teacher used to give me my last period off, which was a study period in high school. And I was playing ball for the high school team, and then when we weren't playing and Katanning was playing, I used to go to Katanning to play. And they used to give me 50 cents a day meal money for one evening. Things have changed since then. So then,
you were a big strapping kid then.
Well, I was the biggest kid in high school,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. You got big shoulders.
Well, I suppose I was probably 6 foot, 6 foot one when I was in high school, and tall, skinny kid, and I played a little bit of everything, and coal mining town, and I just wanted to go down and see if I could make the ball club, and well, here I am, 52 years later.
52 years later.
That's how long I've been in the game.
I tell you, not many rival that record of 52 years in professional baseball.
Well, that's a pretty good record. It's a record as a lot of people have been around a long, long time, but I've been in it never since 1939.
Mm-hmm. Of course, during the Depression, so you scraped a living wherever you could,
yeah,
especially
was,
in those coal mining towns.
Well, you know, a funny story, when I was a bad boy, I'll call it the semi-pro team in the 8th Ward, the superintendent of mine was a great baseball fan. You had to win. It was like, you could call him, I wouldn't call him a George Steinbrenner. He had to win.
Yeah.
And I was a bad boy, and my gang were used to shag balls, and we had enough tools to play with regardless how things were, because I was the bad boy, and my kids from my neighborhood, we were all the bad boys. So Anyhow, every time we needed a bat, we used to put the baseball equipment behind to paste behind the office. And Mr. Craig and Jack Love, the man, used to stand on the front of the office on the steps and talk after the ball game's over. Well, I had a bat down my pant leg, thinking I was getting away from them, and I had my gang walking around me so nobody could see. Anyhow, when I made the Greensburg Club, Jack Love, the manager, come down, and we and I had a cup of coffee, and he said to me, he says, "Steve, you remember when you have that bat down your pant leg?" I looked at him, he says, "You know what?" He says, "Yeah, we stay up there and just laugh at you."
What class was Greensburg? Was that
called? Well, in those days, they called it D. Class D.
From is there, that the same as the Pony League?
I would say it's probably, I would say it's the same category,
okay.
Yeah.
And who were some of the neighboring towns that were in that Pennsylvania State League?
Greensburg and Butler and Johnstown and Charleroi and Washington, Little Washington, Pennsylvania.
Okay, where they're on the other side of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that was all close by. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to Akron, Ohio. I went to Eastern Maryland. Joined the
so Baltimore. You play those times, you just got on a bus and off to the next day or the middle of the night?
That's the way it does it in minor leagues. It's still that way today. And I don't think that's going to change much.
No, I don't think not many commuter planes for the...
not in the minor leagues.
Not in the minor leagues. What'd you do on the buses? Just sleep? Play music?
Well, I'll tell you something. There's more fun in the minor leagues than there is in the big leagues.
Guys are looser?
Well, everybody's wants to get to the big leagues. Of course, that's the purpose of professional baseball. But yeah, in the minor leagues, they make a little more money now in the minor leagues, and conditions probably a little better, but also it's much more expensive. But in those days, there was somebody on a bus that could play a harmonica, play a guitar, play whatever you play. And you really had a lot of fun,
sing along, play
cards. Oh, yes, and we made songs up about the manager and so on and so on, but it was really, you had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And the trips were long, and the buses weren't Greyhound buses like they have now, but we survived and had a lot of fun and really enjoyed it. And I hear from fellas now that you hear from once in a while that you played ball with many, many years ago.
Who are a couple of the fellas that you've heard from recently that goes back 52 years?
Well, I can't go back 52 years, but Frank Bozak, I hear from him once in a while. I think he's still in Binghamton, New York. Tony Sams played in, we were together in Akron, Ohio, and I hear from him every once in a while, and I get up that way and give him a call. It's kind of interesting to go back.
The uniforms you had were old, baggy, woolly, hot things. What were they, cast offs from
those days, in the Yankee organization, I'm sure all the organizations operated the same. The big leaguers get new uniforms every year, and the last year's uniforms goes down to the minor leagues. And it's been that way up until, and might still be that way in some cases.
Now, in the American Association, let's take the old Kansas City Blues, farm team of the Yankees in those days. But they had their own uniform. They didn't have pinstripes. I guess they did have pinstripes, didn't they?
Yeah,
I guess they just changed the lettering then.
Yeah, the Yankees, I think their whole organization wears pinstripes.
Okay, so that's why they just did had uniforms.
Yeah, well, in AAA, I'm assuming that when you're in AAA, you get new uniforms. But the old uniforms. And also maybe the uniforms from the AAA might have been passed down and for spring training or whatever.
Well, you might have had Joe DiMaggio's old Yankee uniform and it'd be worth $1 million today.
Well, it might be. It sure could. The way things are today, it could be.
Right. So you just got on a bus, went from one town to another, and you had the boarding house and meals for $5 a week.
That was in 39. Yeah.
Paid, maybe $100 a month if you got paid at all?
Well,
or were you paid
I think in those days $75 was period in a Class D league. Mm-hmm. I was only there for about 5 weeks in Greensburg, and I went to Eastern Maryland in Eastern Shore League with the Yankees. And down there, the people in those small towns were very, very nice to you. I mean, We had a fellow there that owned a drugstore and was a great baseball fan, and every Sunday we used to meet at his place and have a picnic out in the backyard. You know, it was all night baseball, but Sunday, and people would invite you for dinner and what have you. Look, the small towns were a lot of fun.
Does that still go on in the minor leagues today, where people in the towns invite the players?
I'm assuming it does, because it's they like the ball players, and they're small towns, and the kids are away from home, and they appreciate it, and I would say it's pretty much the same.
Nancy and I thought about doing it this summer. We didn't, of course, you know, I didn't want to make a phone call out of the blue, and they say, well, who's this character, but we thought about inviting some of the Fort Lauderdale Yankee players, you know, if they some of them come over and have dinner.
I think they'd love it. They'd love it.
Well, I'll have to call the manager over there and just tell them, and I'll tell them I know Steve Suchok, and that'll be my character reference. But I think they would. I think, you know, being away from home probably for
the
first
time. I don't
think
the players' attitudes are, in the minor leagues, as much different than they are, because even though they're making a little more money today than we did in old days, but prices tripled or quadrupled since then. So it's pretty much the same.
What was the field? Describe the field at Greensburg where you first started.
Well, you go back to
grass infield.
Yeah, the fields were pretty good. Sometimes the showers didn't work, and some, of course, when I was playing in the big leagues too, some showers didn't work. You went to Chicago and somebody turned a. I'm not going back in the old days before things really improved. Now everything's first class, but you'd go into Chicago and somebody would turn on, and the next shower would turn the water a little hotter, and yours might have got a little colder, you know. But that happened in the minor leagues, and I suppose in some cases it's probably still is happens in
still
the minor leagues, but I don't think too often because everything has improved.
Of course, you played a lot of. You started out playing a lot of night baseball in the minor leagues before it ever came to the major leagues.
In the minor leagues it was all night baseball with the exception of Sunday, and I think it's that way all around the country now, and it's that way in the big leagues now.
And that was one way to get people out to the ballpark. They had to work during the day if they were lucky to have a job, so get them out there. So you went to Eastern Maryland after 5 weeks with Greensburg, and your soul became property of the Yankees.
You know, I think in everybody's life, somebody plays a very, very important part, and a lot of people play a part in their lifetime.
Who was that person for you?
And our manager was a rabbit pal, and I think he owned a farm in Missouri. And Zamaggio was a rookie at that time, and he had that open stance, and he's hitting a lot of home runs. So when I come to Eastern Maryland, I knew I had a problem, but I wasn't smart enough to do anything about it. I couldn't hit the ball to left field. I say I couldn't hit the ball, but generally speaking, I had power, but I wasn't taking advantage of it. So I'd hit it to right field, right center.
And you were a left-handed batter.
I was a right-hand batter, but I was hitting the opposite field, and I knew that sooner or later I got to learn to pull a ball. And anyhow, they tried to change me, the DiMaggio stance and so on and so on, and I couldn't hit, and ball players get down, and particularly when you're a kid away from home and things are going tough for you. So anyhow, one day we worked out in those days in the morning, and I didn't even hit the ball good in batting practice. I said, if I can't make a living, if I can't hit here in the Class D league, I says, I'm in the wrong business. I better go and find me where I can make a living. So, Rabbit Powell was, you learn something from everybody, you learn a lot of things from him. So he was a cool cat, and he's sitting in the grandstand. I went and shouted, I'm quitting, I'm going home. So he said, Steve, I sat down, he said, what are you going to do when you get home? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, listen, why don't you stay here? And my father was pretty sick at that time, and he said, why don't you stay here? The season doesn't have that far to go. And he says, finish out the season, collect your paychecks, and make your mind up next winter what you want to do. In the meantime, I cooled down a little bit, and I said, tell you what, I said, I hadn't been doing anything and with the bat, and I says, I'll give it another week's try. And if I can do it, if I don't start hitting a week, I says, I'm in the wrong business. So I got two base hits that night, but they weren't good. It's their wounded quills. It's like I found $1,000. And then from then on out, I just got help with the bat and ended up, you know, hitting well and starting to enjoy the game, got confidence in myself. And So Rabbit played. Rabbit could have left me gone home just as well as not.
That's right. But he stayed around and offered a few words.
Yeah, and that was, I'll never forget that. Yeah. I'll never forget that. And those things helped me while I was in the game, when I was managing and playing, and even in the scouting, about talking to people.
Did you find that as you went from in the leagues, minor leagues, that there were a number of people that spotted and gave you a piece of advice? Did that carry on through the major leagues?
I think it happens all the way through in baseball. I think the ball players, see, in those days we didn't have instructors.
The manager, coaches and everything.
But ball players would help. Ball players are really a fine bunch of people. They, you know, once in a while you hear they might get in an argument, they might get in a fight, but that happens during the course of a season. But when there's a problem, everybody's there to help you.
Even if you might, that guy that you're helping could be getting your job.
Hank Majeski and I were with the Yankees, and we were both, I didn't know what I was, and I don't know if that time the Yankees knew what I was in 1946, when we had a lot of ball players, and Hank was a third baseman, and I was working out of third base. I think nobody knew what they wanted to do with me at that time, and Hank used to help me a lot at third base, and I mean, one of us had to go. And, you know, and Hank, he went to the Athletics and joined him in Cleveland. And so the day he got told that he was joining the Athletics in Cleveland, I says, Hank missed the plane. He says, why? I says, Bob Feller's pitching tomorrow. Don't break in against Bob Feller. That's when he could throw hard and wide.
A lot of hop on that one.
Yeah, and he was a very fine gentleman, and like I say, you made a lot of fine people in this world.
Going back before the war, then, you played in the Eastern Maryland League in 39. Stayed there for the season, 1940?
We played, as you move up, it's like going to school, first grade and so on and so on. And in those days, they used to have AAA, AA, A, B, C, and D. So where I come from, D League, next year I went to Akron. I hit 25 home runs in Akron. I had a great year. My eyes went bad. The Yankees sent me to John Hopkins Hospital. And the following year, I went to Norfolk, Virginia. And the next year, I went to Binghamton. And while I went to spring training with Kansas City. And
what was that, 41 then?
Yeah, 42. I went to spring training at Kansas City.
Of course, they just won the pennant in 41, didn't they? And or 39, maybe it was that
40,
way.
Well, I don't know.
But that was a big powerhouse in those days.
Yeah, well, Kansas City and Newark were both Yankees, and they had a lot of good ball players in those days. But I was at 42. I was spring training with Kansas City, and Levy didn't make the Yankees, so he came back to Kansas City, and I went to Binghamton.
Levy.
Big first baseman by the name of Levy. Oh, okay. L-E-V-E-Y, I guess is spell his name. I don't know what happened to him. So then I went to Eastern League and had a great year. I led the league in everything. Ralph Kiner was in the league, and you know, we had Ellie Reynolds and Red Embry and God, there's Warren Spahn, you name them.
You all came up with them in the Eastern League?
They were all in the Eastern League, yeah. And I won the Most Valued Player Award, and me and Ralph Kiner, both of us were fighting. He was in Albany, I was in Binghamton. We're fighting for the home run record. And I hit 13 and Ralph hit 12 or vice versa. And, you know, that wasn't many home runs, you know. And Ralph Kiner, well, you know, about him, the rest is history. And then from there, I went to war.
So in 42, you were with Binghamton. They were in the Eastern League, Double A, I guess.
No, that was an A League.
A League.
That was an A League.
And your team won the pennant that year.
Yeah, Eddie Sawyer was the manager, and I was voted the most valuable player.
What were your stats for the year, remember?
Well, one time I was hitting around July, I'm going to guess at this. I was hitting about 392, and I wanted to get to the big leagues that year because Uncle Sam was pushing me pretty good, and they left me out to finish out the season, and I led the league in runs batted in and batting average and extra base hits. I don't know what all, but anyhow.
But you had good impressive stats.
Yeah, well, I was the only one to hit 300, and I start saying when I was hitting 390, says, well, I'm going to make every... I didn't know anything what was going on in those days. I said, I'm going to make every scout in the country come up here to see me. Uh-huh. And I thought the way I was hitting, I might reach the 400, and I went 0 for 5 that night. From then on out, it was all downhill. if the season would have gone 2 weeks longer, I wouldn't hit 300. I think I ended up hitting 315 or something like that.
You were on base half the time then with the walks and everything.
Well,
you didn't spend.
Yeah, I was.
50% of the time, probably.
I would say it was the best year I ever had.
Well, that's it. So you got called up by Uncle Sam after the season of 42
in
the U.S. Army.
I come home in 46 and joined the Yankees, which you know, I hadn't played in 3 years, like a lot of other players, I guess. And I really didn't belong with the Yankees in 46. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to the minor leagues, but...
May I say, interrupt you for the record?
Yeah.
Steve glossed over his 3 years in the United States Army defending this nation and was honored by our government for many acts of heroism. Now, he may feel too modest to say that, but a distinguished military record. So he came back with the Yankees in 46.
I didn't belong there because I hadn't played for those 3 years, and I wanted to go to minor leagues, but they couldn't send me to minor leagues because they had to have waivers on it. They had put me on waivers and somebody had claimed me. So I kind of lost the year.
Mm-hmm.
I finally did get a chance to play. They were looking for another Lou Gehrig. They tried six or seven guys at first base, and they finally put
George
me.
George McQuinn and...
Well, we had Johnny Sturman, we had Nick Getman. God, we tried a little. They tried a little bit of everybody, and so they finally gave me a chance in maybe, I'm guessing, late June or someplace. And I was hot with a bat, but I couldn't catch the ball. And I stayed in a lineup until I quit hitting. And when I stopped hitting, why, naturally I was benched. And then the next year I went to Kansas City, and I had a good year in Kansas City. We had the great ball club there because a lot of players from that club went to the big leagues.
And I must also, this is where I first knew of Steve Suchok, because I was an 11-year-old kid in Kansas City. We had moved to Kansas City, and we were a bunch of us guys that played sandlot baseball in the old 3-2 league in Kansas City. We all were members of the Knotho Gang, and we always got a chance to go to the Saturday afternoon baseball game for 10 cents, something like that. And that's where that great team of Kansas City Blues, 1947, that won the pennant. Sorry to say that the Brewers knocked them off in the playoffs, but it was a freak. But I think all but one of the starting lineup the next year went up to the major leagues.
Yeah, well, we had...
And you played a sound game and hit very well in that big ballpark, because that was a lot of real estate out there.
One thing I wanted to do there, everybody does the best they can, but I hit a lot of balls against a center field fence.
That's 450 feet away.
And I hit it, I think, four or five times, but I never was strong enough to hit one over it. But I had a pretty good year there. I think if I remember, I hit 18 home runs, drove in 99 runs or so. But anyhow, we'd hang by in right field. We had Cliff Mapes and Stewart all went
Eddie
to the
Stewart
big leagues. Harry Kraft was there, went to the big leagues, later become a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy Byrne was at that ball club, and Jerry Coleman was there, and Frank Hiller, pitcher, and Halpern, and you know,
Gus Neuerhaus was catcher.
Yeah, we had, there was a lot of fellas went to the big leagues in that.
Right.
It was a great ball club, and a fine, fine manager, Billy Meyer.
Yeah, Billy Meyer, who later, I think, went up to
Pittsburgh
and managed them for a couple, 3 years.
Yeah, he was one of the finest men I've
real
known,
gentleman.
Ever known. A real first class.
Tommy Byrne, now... batters, when they came up against him, did not set their feet in the batter's box. I mean, they had to keep loose. But I think that every time Tommy Byrne was pitching, it must have been the longest game. He got worn out just getting set with every pitch.
Tommy Byrne could have made it in the big leagues, in my judgment, as a pitcher or a first baseman, either one. And if he had control earlier in his career, he could have been in the Hall of Fame. He just couldn't get the ball over the plate. And every time, this is why most managers get ulcers, I suppose. I played in a ball game in Minneapolis, and if I can remember correctly...
Minneapolis Millers, old
man
box.
Yeah, and Tommy used to grunt, and Tommy had a lot of fun in this game. As a matter of fact, he has a lot of fun in life, and very, very good person. But anyhow, we're in Minneapolis playing, and if I remember correctly, he left 17 on bases, walked 15 and struck out 13, and we won the ball game 3-2. But every time you looked up, the bases were loaded, and he had 3-2, and you know he's going to walk them, but he'd get the ball over the plate. And then when he hurt his arm a little later on and went to Seattle in the Pacific Coast League, come back and got the ball over the plate, he still had good stuff.
Yeah.
And he got to be a pretty good pitcher.
But, you know, he'd pitch 175, 180 balls a game.
Yeah, that's right.
But
you know one thing about him? As wild as he was, the guy never panicked, and he had just as much fun in baseball, loosey-goosey, I've ever seen him. What a fine, fine gentleman.
Hank Bauer told me one time, who was playing right field at the time, he said he'd get worn out by the second inning, just getting set.
Yeah, that's right.
He said he wasn't chasing the ball, but he'd get set, you know, and waiting for the batter to hit. And after about a couple of innings, he was worn out. But that was a great ballpark.
Yeah, it was. The fans were great there. They drew well. We had a good ball club, and I enjoyed it in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. Is that where you met your wife?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Was she working for the Kansas City organization?
No, no. She was in the jewelry business. She was a general manager of a jewelry store.
Oh, jewelry store.
Down at the train station.
Oh, Union Station.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that where you met her? Coming off the train one time and
well,
you saw
this
beautiful...
Well, she was a baseball fan. She used to come to the ball game. She had a season ticket and she used to come to all the ball games. And I met her that summer. And
so you spotted her sitting along first base side and... when your mind wasn't on the game someday,
well,
huh?
Those things happen.
Yeah. You're not going to confess too much, are you? One particular highlight that I remember of that 47 season with Carl DeRose, a big, strapping right-hand pitcher that got a sore arm. And it goes back to your comment about Billy Meyer, that Carl DeRose was about to be released in June of 47. And he wanted to pitch one more game. And that was against the Minneapolis Millers, I think, on June 27th, 1947, at Blue Stadium. Would you share some thoughts about that game? I'm sure it still strikes in your memory.
The one thing that you learned something, and I talk about Bill Meyer, what a great man he was and a great manager. Carly Rose couldn't pitch anymore, according to the doctors. The doctor said he was through pitching, could never play again. So he asked Bill Meyer, the manager, he says, Skip, he said, listen, as long as I'm not going to play more, he says, can I just pitch one more game? He says, I can't hurt myself. I'm hurting now. The doctor said I can't play anymore. Bill Meyer, it might be one of the few guys that give him that wish. He went to pitch that night. And he pitched a no-hit, no-run game.
Perfect game.
He pitched a perfect game, and I'm telling you, I think the fans and the ball players. Nobody could be happier knowing that he's never going to pitch again, and that's he would not thinking his arm was certain with every pitch.
Yeah.
And it was just you have to be there and be part of it because you can't put it in words to get the thrill participating and the thrill you got from being with Carly Rose.
Well,
because he was a fine guy, and that's a good way to go out of this
game.
That's
a way to go out. Now, you must have thought, though, that the top of the ninth inning with two out and Babe Barnum of the Minneapolis Millers, who was a big barrel-chested guy, power hitter, was up to bat, that maybe you didn't want that ball coming down your way.
Well, I think most players, when a guy is pitching a no-hit ball game, when it comes to letting the ball game, they don't want the ball hit to them because they might make a boot or whatever the case. And I was the same way. And Babe Barnum, when he come to bat, you were afraid anyhow because he was a big, strong guy, and he could hit a ball a ton. And I played first base, and I was playing halfway, I think, way back on the grass. I didn't want that ball to go get by me. But he hit it my way, and he hit it good, and I just happened to reach out with my left-hand glove hand, and it would have been a two-base hit. The two-base hit wasn't important. Point it. Carly Rose would have lost his no-hitter.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I caught the ball, and I was tickled to death. But he did hit it to me. But I still say, in those situations, I think big league, minor league, or any league, everybody says, don't hit the ball to me.
Don't hit it to me. And Kansas City went on to win the American League pennant. Fantastic season. And the next year, you were up with the Yankees, 1948.
Well, yeah, I was with the Yankees 48, and I had a good spring. Everything was going smoothly for me. George McQuinn was getting older. He was holding out. And I'm just giving you my personal opinion. The way I was playing ball in spring training, they had to play me. If I continued to play as well as I did in spring training. And
spring training was at St. Pete, wasn't it?
St. Pete, and I got hit in the hand with a ball by Art Hoodeman when we were playing the Tigers, and that was it for me for that year. I mean, I spring training was over. I didn't get a chance to do anything anymore. And
did you break your finger or something, or just badly bruised?
No, I broke a rib. I broke this little bone right here, so I couldn't play. My spring training was over. I was in a cast, and so I couldn't take batting practice or couldn't do much of anything until opening day. But by then, I was out of shape. And, of course, George McQuinn come to the picture, and, of course, the rest is history. You know, he turned around. You know, he had a good year.
But
I would have got I probably would have got a chance to play that year.
1948 was a special year because that's when they honored Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
And you were there in the dugout when there was Babe Ruth Day in 1948. I think it was in June, if I remember correctly. And you saw the Babe and all the people that came around to honor him as he was dying of cancer, throat cancer at that time. It was kind of a rainy day, and everybody was scampering for tickets. And I think you told me before that you got a couple of tickets for some people or a couple of buddies in New York that were ever grateful to you.
Yeah, Babe Ruth, that was really a great day. And I had gone to church that morning, and it was raining real hard, and I was hoping and praying that the game wouldn't be canceled, because there's only one Babe Ruth. So I'm having breakfast, and three sailors come up to me and wanted to know if I could get tickets to the ball game. I never saw these sailors in my life.
Yet they recognize you as
so
the Yankee team.
I said, I doubt whether I could help you out, but I says, check in booth 7, and I'll see what I can do. Some people didn't come to the ball game because the weather was that bad, and I was glad that the sun come out and we got the game in. And anyhow, that was a great day for me because all the great ball players were there, and particularly to honor Babe. I had seen Babe play when I was a kid. And, you know, because the world knows, you know, he had a great name and a great ball player. And I'm sure there was tears in everybody's eyes that day. When he come out of the dugout, everybody stood up and applauded. And nobody whistled, nobody yelled. And that was a show of respect. To me, that's probably as good respect as you can get when nobody else. It was just everybody just clapped their hands. And
it was a reverent feeling then.
Yeah, and George Weiss, I mean, Ed Barrow and Babe Ruth, as I understand it, didn't speak for several years.
That's right, when Babe wanted to go
Babe
up to
Babe wanted
manager.
To manage, and from what I hear, Barrow said, go to the minor leagues and see if you can manage. Well, anyhow, when they embraced it, and the pitcher, mind, they both had tears in their eyes. And I think that's what it brought tears in everybody else's eyes. And it was, you know, all the great ball players are there. That played with the Babe, you know, the Dickies and go back.
Bill Dickey.
Bill Dickey was still...
he was still a coach, I think,
for
the
Yankees. Yeah, but anyhow, everybody that played with him was... All the Yankees were there, and it was just a... You had to be there to really get the feeling
to get the feel of reverence.
But anyhow, these three, you know, in those days, the war just ended, and you couldn't get shirts and so on and so on. These three sailors, I don't know, they don't... How they knew me, I don't know, because I wasn't a very good ball player at that time, or if I ever was. But anyhow, my hotel where I was staying, 3 or 4 days later, whatever, there was a half a dozen Arrow shirts for me. And, you know, in those days...
To this day.
You know, and I didn't have a quarter anyhow. You know, I just come home from the service and was broke. But anyhow, I'll never forget that. It was a great day all the way around.
Mm-hmm. That was 1948. That's just when the... pension fund was started in the major leagues, wasn't it?
I think it started in 46.
46?
Yeah, it started in 46.
But, you know, players coming up weren't making, what was the maximum they could make, 5,000?
Oh, I don't know what...
Or, excuse me, the minimum, I'm sorry.
I don't know what... I know I didn't make much, and a lot of young players and particularly the ones just come out of the service, you weren't making enough money to live on. Mm-hmm. And the pension fund started, each player had to kick in $250, and a ball club would match it, and then they'd take $2 every day you played out of your paycheck, and they would match it. Mm-hmm. And $250 to me in those days, and I'm sure to a lot of other young players that just come out of service, was a lot of money. And three players asked me, Joe DiMaggio's one of them, and I'll never forget it, or as far as the other two are concerned too, says, get into it, it's a pretty good deal. He says, if you don't stay for 5 years, you get your money back with 2% interest. And he said, listen, Joe DiMaggio said, if you don't ever get the money to pay me back, don't worry about it. And, you know, you got to appreciate that. That's the way the ball players used to be in the old days. I don't know about today.
And so DiMaggio and a couple of veterans
they wanted to help
the rookies.
They wanted to help the young guys. They sure did. And, you know, that's, I don't know whether it's that way today or not. I mm-hmm. would say probably the ball players today aren't worried about the old timers. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, that's the way they operated in the old days. And I sure appreciate it. And they were really
that helped you get that start to get into the pension fund.
That started in 1946.
And
nowadays, the players don't pay anything to get into the pension fund. That all comes out of the television money.
Oh, that's right. TV royalties.
Yeah, so in the old days when it started, Early Wynn really worked hard, he and along a lot of other players, to get us old timers to start it a little.
And he still is a hard worker on behalf of.
He's worked real, real hard.
So you were on the bench for quite some time in the 48, 1948.
I didn't get much playing time there.
You see, Bucky Harris was manager then, I think?
No. Let me see.
Was it Joe McCarthy?
Joe McCarthy was managed, and then Johnny Noon, Bucky, they left, McCarthy resigned. Johnny Noon finished up the year, and the next year I went to Chicago.
You were traded to Chicago White Sox.
I went for played White Sox for a year. Then I had gone to the Pacific Coast League, and I had 30 home runs for Sacramento. And then Detroit got me, and I spent my rest of my playing career with the Tigers until mm-hmm. I broke my wrist.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you retire from playing baseball in the... About 52 or so?
No, I'm 55. I broke my wrist and I couldn't do much anymore, and I had gone to Little Rock to manage mm-hmm. in the Southern League. And I managed there in a Detroit organization for a year and a half. I went there in mid-season, and Lee McPhail with the Yankees, they were pretty good. That's a really class organization. They never forgot some of the players. Mm-hmm. So he called me on the telephone and asked me that if I'd come back and work for the Yankees. And I went to Binghamton, New York, and managed Binghamton a couple of years, and then Richmond in the International mm-hmm. League, and I've been with the Yankees till I went scouting okay. with the Bureau.
When you managed Binghamton, went back to where you were 15 years earlier as most valuable player, who were some of the players that first year of managing that went on up to the big leagues that you recall, and maybe you gave them some helpful hints and some advice to help them get on the way?
Well, Billy Stafford was my opening day pitcher, 19 years old, and he made me look like a real smart manager, like I knew what I was doing. Everybody said that he couldn't cut it up there. He was too young, and he pitched the opening day for me. And if I remember correctly, he struck out 9 and gave up 3 hits. He went to the big leagues for a little while, mm-hmm. a couple of years. I had Darren Johnson. That was a great ball player for many, many years. And Leroy Thomas, that's the general manager now of the Philadelphia Phillies, played for me. And let me see, Billy Short was up in the big leagues for a little while. He had arm trouble. And I think Darren Johnson is still in baseball now, is a batting instructor. He was, might be in the big leagues with the Angels. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd been around a long time. And he looked like Rock Hudson. He was really a handsome, young, handsome-looking kid. And he was 19 years old, too. We had another guy by the name of Fred Carpenter to come from the California area. He and Darren Johns were supposed to be the two best prospects in California when they were in high school. So Carpenter didn't make it, but Darren Johnson made it and got to be quite a ball player in the big leagues for a long time.
When you were with the Yankees, you teamed up with, you had roommates when you were out on the road. I think, your roommate was that Cliff Mapes?
You had a different roommate. Well, Cliff Mapes was my roommate when I broke my wrist. And my wrist was throbbing that night, and I couldn't sleep in St. Petersburg. It just makes me think about it when you talk about Mapes. And I couldn't understand how I broke my right wrist when I was a right-hand batter. And I got out of bed real slow, didn't want Cliff to get him up. And I'm there in the dark, and I'm standing there, and I want to know how I broke my right wrist instead of my left wrist. And anyhow, Cliff Mapes says, "Rumi, you all right?" He got up. I was a little bit embarrassed. So I says, "I'm only up here trying to figure out how I got hit in my right wrist rather than my left wrist." And we laughed about that. They thought I was losing my marbles. But anyhow, when I was living in New York, Frank Shea was my... Well, we had a lot of roommates. We lived in a...
Frank Speck Shea?
Yeah, we lived in a cheap motel there, and we couldn't afford anything better. And a lot of people, our roommates, we had room for three, and as soon as one guy's wife would come in, he'd leave and somebody else come in. And when Yogi Bear come up, Yogi was our roommate, and we had a lot of fun.
You got any stories for the tape, or?
Frank and I slept in one room, and we had twin beds in the other room. Yogi had sleeping, and there was a door between. We had kind of a little suite, and it didn't have air conditioning in those days, at least in that hotel, and we slept with the windows open, and you could go out. I'm going to say, I'll call it a porch or patio, and Yogi, he had to sleep with the door open. I don't know why, but Yogi was afraid of something. So every time Shea would get up and just try to close the door, Yogi would get up and he'd open the door. So Frank would, every once in a while, late at night, when he thought Yogi was asleep, he'd call out and he'd throw an empty beer can through the window, which was, of course, the window's up, and Yogi would come running in on him. We had a lot of laughs. Yogi's a fine person.
Yeah. He came up out of Newark, didn't he, with Phil Rizzuto?
Yeah.
Newark Bears. And So, in that year of 48, when you were with the Yankees, of course, Cleveland won the pennant that year. They had a fantastic pitching core. What, the Big Four? Mike Garcia, Bob Feller, Bob Lemon, and Early Wynn, weren't they?
Yeah, and they had a good bullpen. They had a good ball club. Lou Boudreau was the manager at ball club.
Last player manager,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah, they had Kenny Keltner maybe Kenny Keltner, Al Rosen probably.
Yeah, Al Rosen came up from Kansas City and Rookie of the Year, I think.
Yeah, good ball player.
And Joe Gordon, was he still playing for the Cleveland in those days?
I can't remember whether he was with Cleveland at that time
I think
Vela might have been with that club. A Mexican player, real good ball player. I'm not sure.
I heard that Joe Gordon was one of the most talented and intelligent ball players that ever put on a uniform.
I'd have to say you heard that right. He had a lot of talent and a gentleman and just a real, real great, great guy.
I think didn't the Yankees trade him for Allie Reynolds and who came up with the Cleveland organization?
I believe you're right there.
I'm going to stop the tape because go to the other side and talk about your coaching career, because that's another part of your many years in professional baseball.